93X presents the Celebration Rock Podcast with Steven Hayden.
This is the Celebration Rock Podcast presented by 93X FM here in Minneapolis. I'm your host, Steven Hayden. You were just listening to Bully, a great band from Nashville that I'll be talking to a little later on in this episode. But first, in an era of media fragmentation, there's only one common touchstone that's left in American culture, and that's the Super Bowl. Tens of millions of people tune in for the game, of course, but all the stuff around the game is also an attraction, particularly the halftime show, the year's single most watched music event. Super Bowl 50's halftime headliner, Coldplay, is a pleasant enough band that writes pretty songs about love and the value of long-term relationships. Coldplay is also a group that tends to inspire a lot of anger in people. Outside of Nickelback, Coldplay is arguably the most hated band on the planet. Social media is all but guaranteed to be a Coldplay turkey shoot when the band does its 15 minutes between halves at the Super Bowl. What is it about Chris Martin's brand of romantic soft rock that drives people crazy? Is it simply the fact that Coldplay writes power ballads like Fix You that strike many as cloying? Or do people secretly love the act of hating Coldplay as an enjoyable pastime? These are the questions that I asked Larry Fitzmaurice, a former Pitchfork editor who now works for Live Nation TV, during our recent State of Coldplay Summit. Here's our conversation. Larry, I'm glad you were able to talk with me today. I like to imagine that in your apartment there's like a red telephone that only rings when people have Coldplay questions.
Yeah, that's not too far off. I don't have a landline, but definitely considering installing one for that reason.
And you know, I'm very impressed. You know, I was looking at Twitter before we got on the phone today, and I saw that you were tweeting about X and Y, and I thought there's no reason that he'd be tweeting about this unless he was like doing homework for this podcast. So I'm very honored, you know, and I hope this sets a precedent for future guests that like when you come on this podcast, you know, prepare, do your homework, or don't even bother showing up.
You gotta know what you're talking about.
So Coldplay is going to be playing at the Super Bowl this upcoming weekend, or it'll be the upcoming weekend when this posts anyway. And you know, they're going to be joined by Beyonce and Bruno Mars. Now, as a Coldplay fan, is this a great thing that they're playing the Super Bowl, or is it in fact the worst thing because you know it's going to be a turkey shoot on Coldplay on social media, and it, you know, it's going to be insufferable, you know, for those 15 minutes?
You know, it's funny because it's like, I mean, I'm definitely curious as to, as a fan, I'm excited because I personally am not, I don't really watch sports that often, so this gives me a pretty good reason to watch the Super Bowl this year. But, you know, I think part of being a Coldplay fan is kind of, I guess, reconciling with the fact that, like, when you tell people you like this band, there's a 95% chance that they're going to be like, well, they're terrible. Like, people love to hate Coldplay. It's something that's really embedded in popular culture. You know, you can almost imagine the, like, as much as they are, like, one of the biggest bands on earth, like, you know, I think even they're probably prepared for for backlash. So, I mean, I think there's something fun about that, too. Like, their music means a lot to me, but I have my bands I don't like too, so I definitely wouldn't begrudge anybody for coming down on Coldplay either.
I mean, I was thinking about Coldplay's career, you know, like their career arc, and I was trying to figure out, like, was there ever a moment when they were cool, you know, or cool is the wrong word, when they weren't like the punching bag, you know, because it does seem like at some point there was a, you know, it turned for them, and I have a theory on when that happened. But you know, let's walk through their career a little bit. Now, you know, they come out with Parachutes, I believe that was in 2000, and then a rush of blood to the Head comes out a couple years later. Both of those records are pretty big hits, and if I remember correctly, they were, like, fairly critically acclaimed. I mean, I think the Parachutes review on Pitchfork was you know, pretty disparaging. But A Rush of Blood to the Head seemed to do well with critics and was a big hit. You know, you have the song Clocks off that record, which ends up being, you know, a signature song for them. Then X and Y comes out in 05, and that's sort of like their Rattle and Hum record. You know, it's this big, bold kind of stab at superstardom, and it sells well, but it doesn't, you know, there's a big backlash with critics. But then they come back with Viva La Vida in 2008. They start working with Brian Eno. That record does really well, sells like 10 million copies worldwide. That record got pretty good reviews. And then after that, it's Milo Xylito, which is a totally ridiculous record. It comes out in 2011. It's a concept record. It's set in this like future dystopia. There's like there's something about like a gang called the Lost Boys, and there's a protagonist named Charlie Brown, and it's supposedly inspired by The Wire or something. I think Chris Martin said that in an interview. And then they put out their last two records, Ghost Stories and Head Full of Dreams. Am I wrong? I mean, they kind of fell off a cliff after that with those two records, both in terms of like their critical esteem, which wasn't very high maybe to begin with, but it's really gone downhill. And then neither one of those albums, even commercially, they haven't done very well. Which brings us to now, and they're performing at the Super Bowl. I mean, does that little synopsis of Coldplay's career, does that ring true for you?
Yeah, no, I mean, that makes a lot of sense to me. And I think that, you know, it's funny because I really like, their later work. I think they've done a lot of interesting stuff. I mean, I think Ghost Stories was pretty bad. We could talk about that in a bit. But to me, like, I think people stopped caring about them around X and Y. I think that's when kind of the critical drop-off point was pretty heavy. And, you know, after that, like, with both Viva and Milo, there was kind of this feeling of like, oh, these records are actually good, as if this is a band that had made three bad albums previously and, you know, objectively not just one. But I would definitely pinpoint X and Y as the point in which everything dropped off for them critically, and I guess in terms of public image too. Is that somewhere where you'd place it as well?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's that record, but I really think that the 40-Year-Old Virgin was the turning point for Coldplay. There's the scene in that movie with Seth Rogen. It's Paul Rudd and is it Seth Rogen?
Mm-hmm.
And they're talking, you know, they're playing video games, and they have that joke about how, you know, if you like Coldplay, you're gay. That whole thing. And obviously, you could read that scene as saying, like, well, you hope that the subtext is that they're making fun of these two, like, idiots for, you know, talking like this. But I think that a lot of people read that scene literally, and they decided that, oh yeah, okay, now it's okay to go after this band. Like, this is the band that goes from merely being a band that I don't like to being a signifier of a certain thing that I am going to be performatively against. You know, because, you know, you talk about how people hate Coldplay. It seems like there's always going to be one band that goes beyond merely being a band that people don't like to a band that people make a point of saying that they dislike, that it becomes a performance in a way. And what they're really saying is that I'm saying something about myself by declaring my aversion to this thing. I mean, does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I think that's definitely an interesting moment, the 40-Year-Old Virgin exchange, because, you know, something that I think rubs people the wrong way about Coldplay is that they're, you know, for a band that is, again, like we are talking about, one of the biggest rock bands in the world, there is something very gossamer and I think some would say feminized about their sound that is off-putting to people. And, you know, I think that's why you could never get away with putting that line in a major motion picture now, but I think that's precisely why, you know, Apatow and Company could get away with having that in that movie. I think Coldplay have always been as much about image or maybe even vanity as they've been about music, which really irritates people. I mean, if you think about it, the video for Yellow is really just one extended take selfie, which is kind of crazy. You know, you're putting your face front and center, and he's the face of the band that's never really changed. I think people, I've seen people refer to Chris Martin as punchable for that reason, and, you know, like, he looks like a very, very sensitive guy, and I get why people pile on him, even though I do not choose to in the end.
Yeah, I mean, I think that you are probably a bigger fan than I am, but my stance on Coldplay is that I feel like they always get criticized for doing the thing that they have set out to do and doing it well. Like, you know, they are not trying to be sort of like a macho, authority-obsessed, I'm sorry, authenticity-obsessed rock band. You know, like, they could compare to U2 a lot. But the difference between U2 and Coldplay is that U2 very much cared about credibility and authenticity. And, you know, you could make the argument that, like, U2 simply has better taste than Coldplay, which I think, you know, is a pretty good argument to make. But I guess I would say, if we're looking at it in a more positive Coldplay perspective, that they're a band that is basically a pop band, and that they are always going to pursue sounds that they feel like are going to appeal to a mass audience. And they have the good thing that a lot of pop music has, which is that they are not hung up on, you know, on having like a guitar, bass, drums lineup. They are not hung up on, you know, having influences that are considered cool by, you know, a certain segment of the audience. You know, they're going to collaborate with Rihanna. They're going to do Tove Lo duets.
Right.
Because they're a pop band, and that's what's happening, and they're going to pursue what's happening at the moment. And, you know, I think one thing that they've done better than a lot of bands that they've been influenced by, U2, Radiohead, you know, all those sort of precursor bands, is that they've integrated, you know, pop music and electronic music, I think, more organically than a lot of those groups.
Yeah, no, I would agree with that. And, you know, it's funny how you accidentally said authority obsessed before, because in regards to Coldplay, because I've always thought to myself, like, you know, my first introduction to Coldplay as somebody who read the music press in the late 90s was seeing in the early 2000s was right after Kid A came out. Spin, I think it was Spin, ran a kind of like who will be the next Radiohead sidebar, and it was a lot of bands who some of which don't even exist anymore, but one of them was Coldplay, and with the notion being that, you know, Kid A was such a drastic departure for Radiohead that Radiohead didn't want to be what people thought Radiohead were anymore, so somebody needed to come and take their place. And, you know, of all those bands, and we're talking Doves, Star Sailor, JJ72, Coldplay were undoubtedly the most successful. And, you know, I always thought the Radiohead comparisons were kind of specious to begin with, but, you know, Radiohead cemented themselves as very, very into secret messages and subtext and, you know, a lot of literary stuff that appealed to, I think, this new generation of rock listeners. That, you know, Coldplay just don't have that. They're not really, they've never really projected that at all. They're kind of a feelings first band, and I think that's definitely provided some kind of unreasonable expectations, so to speak. Well, they are really just a pop band. I mean,
yeah, I mean, it's interesting you bring up those roots, because there definitely was that wave of bands in the late 90s that, you know, if you were going to describe them somewhat reductively, you would say that they were trying to sound like Karma Police without, like, all the George Orwellian stuff in there.
Right.
You know, like these sort of stately piano ballads that kind of swell into, you know, an anthem by the end of the song. And you mentioned a lot of those bands already. I don't know if you mentioned Travis, but, like...
Yeah, them too.
I think, you know, Travis, the Man Who... I feel like that was sort of like a pre-Coldplay record before Coldplay came out. And then Coldplay comes out, and it almost seems like Travis was the bandwagon jumper and not Coldplay. You know, it seems like Coldplay was there first in a way, with, you know, before a lot of those bands. By the way, are there robots having sex at your place? I keep hearing beeps in the background.
Oh man, I hope not. kind of hard to find a quiet place in this office. But,
okay. I was like, I feel like you're being produced by Brian Eno right now. This phone call.
This interview is my Viva La Vida, actually.
maybe it's just in my head. I don't know if people are hearing it. I think it's fine. So, you know, it's interesting. You know, so far in this conversation about Coldplay, it's been almost entirely reactive to people's criticisms of Coldplay. And I feel like that's sort of hardwired into, like, all of the writing that's done about Coldplay. Even people that like that band, it instantly comes from this sort of, like, defensive posture. Like, you have to defend against people who hate this band. And so maybe we should talk about, like, why this band is worthwhile. I mean, you mentioned those sort of post-X and Y records as being your favorite. Like, make the case for this band's importance. Like, why should people who hate Coldplay and are going to scoff during the Super Bowl, why should they give this band a second chance?
Well, I mean, it's funny. That's funny to me because it's just like, I feel like it's really hard to convince people to give a second chance to Coldplay. Like, you know, like, I've been with my girlfriend for 7 years and I've been a Coldplay fan the whole time and she still hasn't budged. I think she's only admitted that a few songs are good at this point. But I don't know. Like, I think that just in terms of melody and expressiveness and consistency, they have been pretty remarkable. Like, you know, they write songs that are... I actually said in a review for Pitchfork of Ghost Stories that I kind of view Coldplay as like this kind of like koi pond architect rock band in which they, you know, it's pretty shallow. But if you are okay with shallowness in music, I think it's very effective. You kind of have to give yourself in to what they're selling a little bit.
Let's pause there for a second. If you're okay with shallowness in music, like, what do you mean by that?
Well, I mean, I think that, you know, a lot of the melodic tricks that Coldplay use are pretty basic. I mean, they write songs that are very kind of easy to get. Like, you know, like that's where kind of they diverge from the Radiohead comparisons, and that Radiohead have always been known for confounding people's expectations. But, you know, and we talked a little bit about the later records in Coldplay's career. The only way Coldplay has really confounded expectations with their listener base is going more pop and bringing in Rihanna for Milo and working with Beyonce and Tove Lo on the new one. And, you know, I think it's notable too that, and this is just my opinion, but those experiments have never really worked. I think Milo Xylon is a very good album, but I think Princess of China, which is the Rihanna song, there's just something wrong with it. Like, I just don't like it. And I would say the same with the Beyonce and Tove Lo collaborations on A Head Full of Dreams. But those are the ways in which Coldplay have kind of appeared progressive, is by appearing to an even bigger listener base.
Although, I mean, I wonder, though, I mean, it seems like at some point, though, with Coldplay, it's turned a little. Because I feel like on their last two records, although I guess, you know, Ghost Stories, it had that Calvin Harris song on there that seemed like that was a pretty big hit. Like, what was that song called again?
A Sky Full of Stars?
Yeah.
That was with Avicii.
Actually. It was Avicii. Okay, sorry.
Yeah.
Sorry. But, I mean, because, like, when I hear them do, like, Rihanna songs and stuff, I respect it on paper because I see what they're trying to do. But I feel like once you reach a certain age, maybe, it starts to look less like you're progressive and more like you're just sort of chasing trends in a desperate attempt to stay relevant. I just wonder if that's what is maybe the perception now with Coldplay.
You know, that's funny to say that because, like, I think that Ghost Stories and A Head Full of Dreams are both very, very distinctive albums to me in that, you know, Ghost Stories is obviously a breakup album about the dissolution of Chris Martin's marriage to Gwyneth Paltrow. And A Head Full of Dreams is almost this, like, you know, this, like, rebound midlife crisis record of sorts. They're the first two records, I think, where you've really been able to feel a sense of age from Coldplay, which is kind of interesting because, you know, A Sky Full of Stars, which you mentioned before, that is the first time Coldplay has ever really nakedly appealed to the EDM generation, a generation that is almost obsessed with youth in kind of a, like, an endless sort of way. So it, there is something kind of inherently embarrassing about when Coldplay has been doing things more strictly in the pop arena. You know, people who really liked Russian Blood to the Head, which a lot of friends and colleagues keep telling me they think is the best Coldplay album at this point. You know, that record is relatively austere and not fun compared to these current albums.
Well, the thing about Rush of Blood to the Head, too, is that if you want to knock Coldplay for, like, what they inspired, you know, which was this generation of, like, you know, sappy, you know, bands playing, like, piano ballads, you know, bands like The Fray and Snow Patrol and all those groups. I mean, it's all traced back to that record, A Rush of Blood to the Head. I mean, that is they haven't really sounded as Coldplay-ish sense as they have on that record. I mean, with like The Scientist and Clocks and all those sort of mid-tempo piano songs.
Yeah, and it's crazy too because I remember listening to I saw Radiohead play during the Hail to the Thief tour at New Jersey's Beleaguered Field Day Festival. I think it was in, it must have been 2002, 2003, and Radiohead set was delayed for hours because of the rain, so they were playing music videos in the arena, and they put on Coldplay as a Scientist, and the entire audience started to sing along, like a packed giant stadium. And, you know, Radiohead takes the stage 2 hours later and plays a bunch of new songs and Kid A stuff, and you don't hear anybody singing along. It kind of felt like a flashpoint moment to me where I was like, okay, like, I guess Coldplay have hit, like, full saturation now. This sound is very much like the sound of modern rock right now, for better or for worse.
Right. And, well, and Coldplay also, you know, they've just written songs that are more adaptable into people's lives. Like, you aren't going to get married most likely to a Radiohead song. You know, you're not going to, like, you know, like if you're married or you have, you know, you have a girlfriend or boyfriend, like, it's more likely that, you know, your song is a Coldplay song, or that you, you know, or that's been integrated into your life in some other fashion, like that. I wanted to get back to this authenticity issue, because I think it's interesting as it pertains to Coldplay. You know, as we were talking about, Coldplay, I think, is unique in that they haven't really cared about credibility. I mean, I guess you could argue that making records with Brian Eno was a credibility move. Although, I mean, that seems to be something that all big rock bands do now, where, you know,
yeah,
U2 did it, Coldplay did it, then Arcade Fire did it, and I would argue that those Brian Eno... Well, actually, I'm sorry. Arcade Fire did not collaborate with Brian Eno. They collaborated with James Murphy, who did a Brian Eno impression on Reflector. It just got worse and worse as you go along. But, I mean, there is something interesting to this. Because now, you know, especially in the music press, it's a very pro-pop era. And authenticity, in a way, is a dirty word. You know, like when you get people talking about an artist being authentic, music critics now, that automatically raises their dander, you know, and there'll be think pieces, you know, aplenty about how authenticity doesn't matter. But it seems like with rock bands, that there is still a patina of suspicion of any group that that embraces pop music a little bit too much, or at least embraces wanting to be big too much. I mean, I think that's true of Coldplay. I think that makes them suspect in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. I think that's been true of bands like the Black Keys, for instance. I think once they became a band that was openly chasing sort of the radio, they became another sort of emblematic band of like something that you could say that you hate in order to perform in a way to show that you're against something. I mean, do you think there's any validity to that?
Well, I mean, I think in Coldplay's case, the authenticity problems have always less been, I don't like what this band stands for, and much more, this band doesn't stand for anything at all. You know, you mentioned a few of their stylistic children, so to speak, with The Fray and, there are 1,000 bands like that. I mean, you could probably trace Howie Day back to Coldplay if you wanted. And those are all bands that, you know, are criticized and kind of sneered upon, and rightly so, by the music press for being faceless and overly corporate sounding, the kind of stuff you'd hear in a supermarket. And, you know, I worked in a supermarket for 4 years, and I can confirm that, you know, Coldplay gets regular airplay right alongside Howie Day.
You do your research for everything. See, you even worked in a grocery store for 4 years to confirm that Coldplay gets played a lot in grocery stores.
Journalism, yeah. you know, I actually have been thinking a lot about Coldplay in terms of another widely hated rock band that plays in the pop playground a little too often, which is Maroon 5. You know, both bands are almost obsessively concerned with sonics on their albums to a fault. They have the best producers in the game. I think the biggest difference is Maroon 5 has never made a cred grab, but I would say late period Coldplay is absolutely reminiscent of Maroon 5 for better and for worse. And I also saw this new record and kind of the upcoming hiatus as Chris Martin trying to transition into being a solo artist, possibly. Like, you can see him doing like Fun on the new album, the Tove Lo duet. You know, that sounds like a Chris Martin song to me. There's no real band interplay there that makes you think like, oh, this is a rock band. You know, solo artists, they usually have to have like a pretty strong personality to put things forward. And I think one of the things about Adam Levine that has always rubbed people the wrong way as a solo artist of Maroon 5 is that, you know, you ask the guy to open his mouth in a public setting that's surrounded by the rest of Maroon 5, and he sounds like an asshole. And, I mean, unfortunately, or I guess fortunately for Chris Martin, he doesn't have enough personality to even invite those sort of criticisms.
Well, I mean, I'll disagree with you a little bit. I do think that Chris Martin does have, I mean, people know who he is, and he's a recognizable guy. I think that the Maroon 5 comparison is really, I think that makes a lot of sense when you consider that, like, in Maroon 5, people know Adam Levine, and it's like four other guys or three. I don't know how many people are in Maroon 5. Are there five guys in Maroon 5?
One would hope.
You'd think so. I think it might be. Anyway, it's Adam Levine and a bunch of other guys, and in Coldplay, it's like Chris Martin. And, like, I think people would say that Gwyneth Paltrow is the second most famous person in Coldplay, even though she's not actually in Coldplay. But, you know, I mean, I know Will Champion. Is he the guitar player? Will Champion?
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
And Johnny Buckland, I think, is in the, he might play bass. And I can't think of the drummer. Do you know the drummer?
Guy Berryman?
Wow.
I swear I'm not looking at Wikipedia.
Okay. I mean, because we would be the first people in history to be able to name all members of Coldplay. I think if we just did it, someone needs to, when this posts, someone let me know if we got it right, because, but you know, the point still stands that like these, both of those bands are just like a good looking guy out front and like a bunch of other guys in the back. And I think you're absolutely right. I think at some point there will be a Chris Martin solo record. Has he put out any like singles by him, like Chris Martin's singles yet?
He hasn't, no, which is really surprising. It's 15 years without a single attempt. Maybe he didn't have the confidence. I don't know. There is kind of this like very like midlife crisis confidence to the new record that makes me think like, oh, this guy's going to go for it really soon, and I guess we'll see how it goes.
I mean, it seemed like in a way that Ghost Stories was a solo record in like all but name only. I mean, it's a very kind of stripped down record. It's clearly a divorce record for Martin. I mean, that's ostensibly a Coldplay record, but I mean, it seems like it's become much more Chris Martin oriented, maybe.
Yeah.
On the last couple records.
Well, it's funny too, because when this band started out, when they started out in the late '90s, when they were still at university, as they say, they had Will Champion right before they released Parachutes. You know, he was briefly fired from the band, and then they brought him back in, and they had a band meeting where they decided, like, you know, this band is a democracy and everyone makes all the decisions so far, like, throughout this band. And if they've in fact held to that for 15 years, there really is no room for Chris Martin to strike out and do anything that sounds soloish. But these last two records, I feel like, definitely been creeping in. Maybe it's just collective fatigue. I don't know.
I mean, I don't know. Bands always say that, and I'm always skeptical when that's said. I mean, you know, is Will Champion, who, again, I think he's the guitar player in Coldplay.
It turns out he is the drummer.
Is he the drummer?
He is the drummer.
So is Buckland the guitar player?
He is the guitar player.
And
yeah.
Berryman is the bass player?
Yep.
Okay, so Buckland, do you think Buckland is really going to say, hey, Chris, you know what, I know I'm the guitar player, but I don't want to write a single recognizable guitar riff in the entire history of this band, okay? Let's turn the guitar down and raise your voice up and raise your piano up. Like, I just don't see that happening. I feel like by, like, the third or fourth record, he'd be like, hey, man, I just wrote Barracuda. You know, I've got a Barracuda-type guitar riff here. I want to throw this in. Come on, this is clearly Chris Martin's realm here, and he can decide, you know, whether they stay together or not.
Maybe democracy in Chris Martin's terms is I can say no whenever I want, and I can leave too. I mean, you never know. It's funny because I think to circle back on kind of talking about the turkey shoot that is going to be their Super Bowl performance, you know, when they announced that the Head Full of Dreams would be their, like, final chapter and that they're going on hiatus, which, you know, nobody stays broken up these days. I don't believe that for a second, but they'll be back in 5 years for sure. But, you know, you have this collective social media exultation of, like, finally, they're broken up. Like, you know, people who probably hadn't even listened to a Coldplay album in years were relieved that this band was even threatening to call it quits. And, you know, the fact that they did so in a very silly Coldplay way by comparing this album to the final Harry Potter book, you know, that gives people just more ammo.
Right. You know, and I wonder, like, is there some, you know, I don't really think Chris Martin is doing this, but, you know, the fact that, like, Coldplay put out a song called, like, Every Teardrop is a Waterfall, you know, it just seems like they've done things in the last 3 or 4 years that make me think that, Martin is either over the fact that they're not, you know, that they're going to be mocked no matter what, or that he is, like, maybe subtly trolling people and is saying, okay, you know, you think we're bad now? Okay, we're going to put out a song called Every Teardrop is a Waterfall. Or, you know, we're going to do, you know, we're going to do this Rihanna duet that's, like, kind of a train wreck. But
no, it does seem like the last three Coldplay albums have been, like, explicitly made as, like, trigger warnings for people who don't like Coldplay. Stay away from this if you think Coldplay's too ridiculous, because it's just going to get more ridiculous from here. I don't know if it's intentional. Like, I think what's something that's really endearing to me is that even at their most self-serious as a band, we kind of talked about how Chris Martin doesn't have quite the personality of Adam Levine. I think I misspoke when I said he has no personality, because I do think that there's always been the self-deprecating streak to him in interviews and in the extras appearance, for example, where, you know, it's clear that, you know, he understands that not everybody loves this band. Maybe he's in on the joke a little. Maybe he just doesn't care. I mean, if I had as much money as him, I don't think I would care, personally.
Right. But, well, and he shouldn't care. And, you know, I think this is, it's a hard thing to do, especially now that it's so easy to hear what people say about you, to not internalize criticism, you know, like...
Right.
To go on a little bit of a tangent here, you know, like Macklemore put out that song this week, White Privilege 2. It's this 8.5-minute dirge, basically. I don't even know if it's really a song. It's just him sort of talking, it seems like, for about 8.5 minutes. But you can tell listening to that song that Macklemore has heard every negative thing people have said about him, and he's internalized it, and he's, in a way, maybe not even consciously, but he's responding to it, and he's trying to placate those people when... He's never going to placate those people. Like, Macklemore is like Coldplay in that there's a performative aspect to people hating him. That, like, they enjoy hating him. You know, they have fun hating him. If you hate him, you will get favorites and retweets on Twitter. And it's supposed to say something about you, that you hate Macklemore, that you are positioning yourself against this thing. And I feel like Coldplay, I think there was a period maybe in the mid-2000s where Chris Martin was... trying to placate the people that didn't like him, and he would do it in sort of a self-deprecating way.
Yeah.
And also, I think, you know, maybe the Brian Eno collaboration was a way to kind of say, like, hey, no, we're serious. We're a serious band. But it seems like lately he's just sort of set that aside and realized that that's never going to happen. He's never going to placate those people. And, you know, and if I could offer advice to Macklemore, if he's listening to this podcast, I would say, hey, don't listen to your critics. Like, keep making dumb songs like Thrift Shop. You know, Thrift Shop was a dumb song that a lot of people loved. And you don't have to have this sort of, like, defensive streak, you know, responding to people who are never going to like you anyway.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, I mean, you know, White Privilege, too. I mean, I feel like you could say that Coldplay's entire career is a prequel to White Privilege 2, so to speak, and it's purely in nomenclature alone. And I don't think Chris Martin cares. I said when this record came out, A Head Full of Dreams, I think I said on social media that, you know, like, he seems like the kind of guy to me who would record a song with Beyonce and then go to the beach and get cornrows or something, and seemed totally cool with it. Like, he's living his best life, as the kids say, and I think that's, like, I think there's something almost, like, shamelessly amazing about that. It makes me respect him more for not caring, and, you know, I don't think that's something that's obvious to the bystanders who throw rocks at Coldplay, but... Well, you know, there's this lack of self-consciousness that's seeped into their later work that I think is really interesting.
Well, and it's, you know, you mentioned Beyonce, and, like, you know, Chris Martin is friends with Beyonce, and he's friends with Jay-Z, and he's recorded with Jay-Z, and I don't know, they go out and have ice cream together or whatever people like that do. I mean, there is, you know, for all the people that accuse Coldplay of being this white bread band, And that often will come from, like, white music critics talking about, like, how white bread Coldplay is. There is this sort of, like, weird credibility that they have among rappers that they've had over the years. Like, you know, like Frank Ocean sampled Coldplay on his the mixtape before Channel Orange. I can't remember. Nostalgia Ultra. Which I think is sort of an interesting thing, too, with Coldplay.
Yeah, and Kanye had Chris Martin and Avril Lavigne. I mean, I'm sorry, and Adam Levine on Graduation. Funny dovetail there. You know, their relationship, I guess Coldplay's convergence with black culture has always reminded me of Steely Dan. You know, when I was like 11 or 12, the first time I ever heard Asia was because Pharrell had name-checked it as his favorite record of all time. And when I went to see Pharrell live last year, you know, all the pre-show music was Steely Dan. I think that comparison can possibly be extended in that, you know, I don't think Coldplay are as quote unquote smart as Steely Dan, or at least I don't think they'll ever be viewed that way.
You don't need the quotes around smart, okay? I think we can just say straight up, Coldplay is not as smart as Steely Dan. You know, and we're coming from a place of love with Coldplay, but you know, like Donald Fagen would hate this comparison, by the way, which is why I love that you're making it.
But I think it stands. I mean, they're both very, you know, sonically perfect sounding bands who, in terms of production and songcraft, they really can't be faulted. And I also think that I think the last 10 years. Has seen younger generations really coming to Steely Dan as a formative influence. I feel like in 20 years, maybe Coldplay will be the same too. Maybe people will look back on those records and say, like, these guys were actually a pretty solid pop rock band. I mean, that's my hope, at least. I'm vindicated. It's all about me in the end.
I see. The comparison I would make is that I see Coldplay being like Journey. Like the Journey of now, like where there's going to be a period after they break up where it's not very cool to say you like them, but they will remain popular. And then like in like 10, 15 years, someone will put Yellow in a prestige drama. At a critical point, and people will be like, wow, you know, Coldplay actually has like a lot of really great songs. And then they're going to have that kind of appeal. I see them as more of like, you know, this generation's like power ballad band. They're writing like the Don't Stop Believin's and Faithfullies of the early 21st century.
Yeah, and you know, the newsroom tried that with Pick Shoe.
It's too soon.
Way too soon.
Too soon. It took
10 years for the dust to settle on Pick Shoe before you even try that.
I mean, I feel like there Aaron Sorkin must have said, you know, people on Twitter hate me. What can I do to really get these people going? Oh, I got it. I'll put Fix You in the newsroom. Like, this might actually detonate Twitter if I do this, which it didn't work, unfortunately, for Aaron Sorkin. Did you see that episode, by the way?
Oh, yeah.
Oh,
That was actually the episode that convinced me to stop watching the newsroom.
Oh, man.
It's embarrassing because I was like, I think the story's still good, like, but it just makes it cheap to me all of a sudden.
Well, didn't he play like
poor application?
And he played the whole song, right? Wasn't it the whole song? God, yeah, because this went on forever. And you feel like, and you know, the thing too is normally when you put a song in a movie or TV show, the idea is for, you know, you want the song to comment on the scene, but you hope it's not quite as explicit as something like that, where, you know, because if I remember the newsroom, it was something about like Will McAvoy and what was the news director? She had like a ridiculous name, the news director.
Oh my God, I can't even remember at this point.
We're blanking on newsroom. We're probably getting too deep into the newsroom weeds anyway. Maybe we should just back out of there. Just to kind of wrap up here, to circle back to the Super Bowl, what is your sort of dream set list for the Super Bowl? Because they'll play probably four songs or so. I mean, like Beyonce and Bruno Mars are in there, so I don't know how that, you know, cuts into Coldplay songs necessarily, but like if you could pick Coldplay set list, like what songs would you want to hear?
Man, where do you start? I feel like they have, like, my dream set list would be them doing A Sky Full of Stars, which I think Ghost Stories is their worst album, but I think that song is just so perfect in its Coldplayness. they're able to replicate that formula at least once an album. I think that's great. I would love to see them do that. I'm not looking forward to the fact that we're practically guaranteed him for the weekend and Princess of China, which I think are two very bad songs. I'm curious as to where Bruno Mars is going to play in this. You know, one thing that's interesting to me is that this is the first time a rock band has just taken over the halftime show since The Who in 2010. The only rock band that's appeared between then and now on the halftime show is Red Hot Chili Peppers a few years ago. I think that was the year that Bruno Mars played, but I'm not certain. Yes, it was. Red Hot Chili Peppers appeared with Bruno Mars for one song. So, you know, like, it's almost reversed in a way where you could see Bruno Mars just doing one of his own songs and letting Coldplay get back to business here. That being said, I would love to hear Bruno Mars do a duet with Chris Martin on Clocks. I think that would be amazing. it just seems perfect for everybody. So for me, it would be a Sky Full of Stars, Clocks, 30 seconds total of Beyonce and Rihanna, and then just do an eight-minute version of Fix You to close it out.
I mean, it seems like I could see Bruno Mars and Chris Martin doing, like, Just the Way You Are, because I feel like that's already kind of a Coldplay song. Although he did that, Bruno Mars did that at the Super Bowl like a couple years ago, so maybe he can't do that. You bring up an interesting point about how there have been no rock bands on the Super Bowl for the last several years. And I'm wondering, you know, we were talking about how Coldplay is sort of, you know, they're a popular punching bag. They're a signifier that you can easily throw out there to get a laugh or to you know, position yourself against if you want to do that. And, you know, we have Coldplay and we have Nickelback. Those are probably the two bands that are the most sort of easy to hate. Who's going to replace those bands? Like, have we already progressed to a point, like, where rock bands aren't popular enough to be hated like that?
It certainly seems that way. I mean, you know, it's really hard to think of a band rising up to take their mantle when they're gone. like, a band that has a solid catalog of consistent hits. And, you know, you mentioned this in the beginning of our conversation here, but again, it's worthwhile to note, Adventure of a Lifetime, or rather A Handful of Dreams, it did not debut at number one on the chart. So even Coldplay is starting to kind of fail at being the next Coldplay. It's really hard to imagine who would take their place there. I mean, I think Maroon 5 would be definitely the next up, but with the difference being that they've always been critically indefensible, whereas I think, as this conversation proves, there's always people willing to go to bat for Coldplay.
Well, it's like Imagine Dragons, you know? They had it,
yeah.
And then they kind of faltered, you know? You got to pick it up, Imagine Dragons. You could be the one. Or, you know, it might be up to 21 Pilots at this point. They're going to have to...
If they get their act together, which I suspect they never will, I mean, but the Killers could easily take these next 5 years and step back into that place of most hated mega popular U.S. rock band.
I think they had the momentum when they were, you know, they had the bolo ties and the vests without the shirt on underneath, you know, like the Sam's Town
right.
era. And then, you know, something happened and they could not keep it going. So, yeah, I don't know. I think it's, if I had to put my money on it, I would say 21 Pilots is
the
band.
Yeah, you might be right.
They need, you know, they're already pretty popular among, like, on rock radio, but they don't have a ton of name recognition in the mainstream. So they need to go on the Grammys and, you know, do a song with, like, Ty Dolla $ign or something, you know, to, like, raise their profile. And then maybe then they can start to be hated as much as Coldplay is hated.
I mean, maybe this is a good tying off discussion, but I feel like, you know, I said to a friend, like, a day after David Bowie passed, like, whatever the Grammys do for this, for their David Bowie tribute, it's going to be terrible. and but I thought that maybe they would do something like Coldplay. I think the names I threw out were like Coldplay, Ty Dolla $ign, and Mike Love. And my friend said, well, what if they just do 21 Pilots and Kendrick Lamar? And I was like, oh my God, that is very, very likely, which is kind of scary. But yeah, I guess we'll see.
See, I'll say like Melissa Etheridge and let's see, who else? Like Melissa Etheridge and B.O.B. are going to do Heroes.
You might be right.
That will be the Grammy tribute to David Bowie and all that. So, well, Larry, it's been great talking with you, man. And you can put the red telephone down for now.
I'll let cool off for a bit. Yeah, thank you so much for having me. This is a lot of fun. I love talking about Coldplay, as you know. So.
Absolutely, man. Well, hey, take care. So that was Larry Fitzmaurice and our State of Coldplay Summit. And I hope you enjoyed that. But for now, I think it's time to clear the palate with something a little noisier. Alicia Boniano grew up not far from where I am in Minneapolis in Rosemont. But she didn't become involved in music until she moved to Nashville for college to study audio engineering. It was there that the 25-year-old Boniano discovered bands like Sonic Youth and the Pixies, who inspired her to learn guitar, write songs, and form the band Bully. After a couple of acclaimed EPs, Bully signed with the Columbia Records and put out its full-length debut, Feels Like, in 2015. While it wasn't a big hit, Feels Like seems like one of those records that's going to gain in stature over time, as Boniano matures as a songwriter and record maker. But she's already gifted at the art of crafting catchy, gritty fuzz pop. I met up with Boniano when Bully came through town recently on its latest tour. So how long has it been since you lived in Minnesota?
Let's see, I'm 25, and I moved to Nashville when I was 18, so 7 years.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And we were talking before I started recording about how you're actually feeling a little bit nostalgic for the weather, because like right now it's like, I think it's literally 0 degrees
yeah.
outside. It might even be less than zero right now.
That might be a little bit overdramatic for me, of me to say, but yeah, I mean, I appreciate the cold weather, and I haven't lived around it in a long time, so it just brings me back.
I mean, you were saying before that you kind of still feel like a Midwesterner.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like, what do you mean by that? Is there something you feel like is inherent to being a Midwesterner?
I don't know. I don't really know how to explain it except for certain, you know, the only way I really know how to explain how I feel is when I moved to Nashville, it definitely took me a little while to adjust. And when I go back to Minneapolis or Chicago, I have a kind of overwhelming sense of being at home for some reason. I don't know exactly what it is, but it's definitely there.
Right.
Yeah.
And you grew up like a little bit outside of Minneapolis, right?
Yes. Yeah. I grew up in Rosemont, Minnesota.
And like, were you born and raised there?
I was, I kind of, let's see, well, we moved around quite a bit, so I spent a little time in Maple Grove, and then moved to Naperville, which is about 40 minutes outside of Chicago for a couple years, and then we moved to Rosemont.
Okay.
Yeah.
And you said you're 25, so
yes.
You were born sort of right after all of those sort of legendary 80s Minneapolis bands sort of came and went.
Yes, and I wasn't actually born here. I was actually born in Germany.
Oh, born in Germany, okay.
I think I moved here. I don't know how old I was when I was moved here, but very young.
Very young. Like, how aware were you of that sort of like rock history in Minneapolis growing up?
I was not aware of it at all. I wish that I was.
Yeah.
I'm really bummed out that I wasn't, because some of my favorite bands have came out of Minnesota, The Replacements and Husker Du. And I wish that I would have known more of what was going on. But also, even throughout high school, I don't feel like a bunch of my peers were playing music together or in bands or anything like that, and going to shows wasn't a huge deal. I remember there was a DIY all-ages venue in Burnsville that bands would play out of. Yeah, what was it called again?
It's called, I was just there a couple months ago for a show. I was like the oldest person there, like by far.
Yeah.
But I think it's like The Garage.
That sounds really familiar, yeah. But even the bands that played there when we went to shows there were all out of high school. They were like 19 and 20 year olds.
Right.
And that was kind of as far as being involved in any sort of music scene went until I moved and went to college, when I really kind of found out about everything.
Like, were you a music fan growing up? Like, did you follow bands and stuff?
Yeah, I was. I mean, my taste in music was very questionable. I didn't have any cool underground records or it was kind of all over the place. When I was younger, I liked Ace of Base and Motown stuff. And then when I was in middle school, everyone was going through that terrible emo phase. Not like the original emo, like Rites of Spring, like the terrible emo that is still happening now. And then in high school, I remember a lot of people were listening to a lot of stuff that came out of Rhymesayers. A lot of Minnesota hip-hop was going on, I feel like, and that was a popular thing. Yeah, that's kind of the extent of it. And then when I got into college, for some reason, all my friends were listening to... I mean, not for some reason, I know why, because they're great bands, but a lot of bands that came out of the 90s, which is weird because I went to college in 2008, but that's when I was introduced to, like, the Breeders and the Pixies and Sonic Youth and the Replacements and the DBs and Silkworm and just, you know, a bunch of awesome bands that everybody should know about and listen to at some point in their lives. Yeah.
And I know you ended up studying engineering in college. I mean, did you go to college with that plan, or did that kind of happen while you were at school?
No, I absolutely went with that plan. That's kind of how I even ended up in Tennessee. I never thought that I would be there. But my teacher, Jeremy Bartlett, who taught at SES.
And I should say record engineering, by the way, not like...
Yeah, audio engineering, right, not engineering.
Like, exactly.
He taught at SES, and when I was a junior or a senior at Rosemont High School, we could go over there. It was similar to, like, it was kind of like having an elective, and we could go over there for a couple periods, and I did the audio engineering portion of it, which is just super basic introductory stuff, kind of getting you familiar with Pro Tools and Logic and GarageBand and what a console looks like and, you know, basic signal flow, but almost not even, because I don't think I could have set anything up when I was going there. But it was really cool, and it was kind of the first time that I was in school when I found something that I loved and that I was passionate about. And I think it was also like the first point in my life where I realized that maybe being involved in music wasn't such a stretch, and that it was maybe a little bit in reach. So he found MTSU, which was, you could get your, I kind of made a compromise with my dad. I was like, I really want to go to school for music. He was like, what the hell are you talking about? That's not going to happen. And he was like, if you can find a 4-year degree that is involving audio engineering, like, I'll talk to you about it. So my teacher actually found MTSU, and he was like, you should go there. It was pretty affordable, out of situation, wasn't super crazy. It wasn't like Belmont. And you could get a bachelor's of science in audio engineering. So I went to Murfreesboro, and yeah, I knew what I wanted to do the whole time I was there.
And but at that point, I mean, you hadn't really played in any bands yet, right? I mean, you were but you had this ambition to be into music.
Mm-hmm.
It was just sort of like a way, you were just kind of looking for a way to do it.
Yeah, and what I was doing while I was in that class was just putting together really basic loops and either having my buddies rap over them or I would sing over them, and it was just so bad and so embarrassing, but like, so I was like kind of forming songs, but it was all with software, which is kind of funny if you think about it, because now I do everything on tape and like kind of the opposite of all of that. But I hadn't, besides kind of like writing songs with a keyboard and really basic stuff, I hadn't played in any bands or performed or really played with anybody else.
I mean, I think I read that you said that like maybe in junior high or something you tried playing acoustic guitar and it didn't feel good or it was too hard.
It was super hard, and I'm left-handed. And I remember going into Guitar Center when I was like, I don't know, maybe 13 or 14. It was when I was babysitting, because I used my babysitting money, and I was like, I'm left-handed. And the guy at Guitar Center was like, well, you gotta play right-handed, because like, you're never gonna find anyone that has a left-handed guitar. They're harder to find, blah, blah, blah. So he sold me this right-handed guitar, and just learning to play acoustic guitar was just, so sad. I was so bad at it. It was so difficult. It was just, it seemed impossible. So, I mean, I tried for a long time, but nothing really came of it. And eventually I was like, forget it. This isn't my instrument. This isn't for me.
Well, I can't believe he made you play right-handed. I mean, has he ever heard of Jimi Hendrix?
I know. Kurt Cobain.
Exactly.
A lot of people who are left-handed.
Paul McCartney.
Yeah, but I still play left-handed. Or, I mean, I still play right-handed now. So, I don't know. It's weird. Very bizarre.
Yeah, I remember hearing a story. I think maybe it was Hendrix who had to like flip his guitar upside down, I think.
Yeah. To play left-handed. You get to that point where you're just like, what like, what's going on? But yeah, I actually, like, the first time I started playing electric was because my roommates left it their guitars around, and they were all right-handed. So now I actually do play right-handed. But I always think if I started left-handed, if, you know, I'm like, would I be way better? I don't know. It's hard to tell.
I mean, you have sort of an interesting background because I think, you know, in one respect, you know, you're playing this really sort of like raucous, wild kind of rock and roll music. And then on the other hand, you have this background in audio engineering, which, you know, correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems like that's a very sort of particular, almost tedious discipline in order to make records.
Mm-hmm.
What was it about like that aspect of music that appealed to you that made you want to, you know, actually be involved in like making records rather than just like playing music live?
Well, I'm sorry. So is that what kind of made me want to play rock and roll, or what made me want to make records?
I mean, I guess the dichotomy of that. It's kind of strikes me as like, you know, usually people go one way or the other.
Right.
They want to be like the band on the road that plays shows, or they want to be the sort of the studio people that just kind of commits themselves to that. And it seems like you have a bit of both of that in your DNA. And
I mean, I think for the audio engineering part of it, besides the fact that I really like doing it and it's a challenge for me and it's a pretty difficult thing, a huge part of that kind of kept me going, or why I'm still doing it and never kind of stopped halfway through college, was because everything that works against you when you're trying to do audio engineering, you know, you have all these people who are constantly dropping out of the program. They're like, it's not a real profession in 2016, and your family's kind of like, what are you studying? That's not a real thing, you know? And also, not to ever bring gender anything, because Lord knows I hate that more than anything, but being one of the only girls in your classes, you just feel like you want to prove yourself and you want to do a good job and you want to make it happen and you want to look back and be like, no, I stuck with it and I'm doing it. You know, I can't swear, can I?
No, you can.
Oh, okay.
Let her rip.
Be like, fuck everybody who the whole time was like, that's not a real major, or it's not practical, or it doesn't make sense, and just show people that if you really like it and you care about it, you can make it work. And not all the time, or maybe not forever. I don't know. In 10 years, maybe I'll be waitressing again. But I think that has a lot to do with it and why I wanted to pursue it and stick it out. And then I guess I would say the same for music, because it didn't seem, it's something I knew that I've always wanted to do, but it seemed so out of reach, and it made me want to do it even more, and just work extra hard and be that person who, especially in Nashville, because like every 13-year-old and 15-year-old is in a band playing music. Their parents know what's going on. Like, they grow up around being in a band, being a really professional thing, not just a hobby. So it's really intimidating to kind of get there, and then, you know, you didn't start playing guitar until you're 19 or 20 and do it. But a lot of that just made me want to do it even more and take myself seriously, because nobody else would. Not to say that was the case. There's definitely people that did take me seriously and, you know, didn't laugh at what I was doing. But a lot of the time I felt like, when you say you want to play music or have a degree in audio engineering and do that as a profession, a lot of people kind of roll their eyes and they're like, all right, have fun waiting tables. So I think that kind of has a lot to do with why I was so driven to do both of those things, being as different as they are.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned that you've only been playing guitar for like, you know, 6 years or so. Well, when you started writing songs, you must have had a sense of like, I mean, was there a sense that you had that you could write songs fairly naturally, and that you could, you know, I mean, you said you were writing songs like on a keyboard in high school, but, you know, writing the kind of songs that you do, I mean, because your songs like are really catchy and melodic and there's a lot going on. I mean, did you feel like you had a natural aptitude for that when you started doing it?
Yeah, I think finding a melody and writing lyrics has always came naturally to me. With that being said, lyrics is the hardest part for me. It's usually what I spend the most time on. But as long as I can remember, I've been, like, finding alternative melodies for songs on the radio, or seeing if I can pull out a harmony, or just writing stuff in my head and writing it down. When I was little, I had a good friend who had a really awesome voice, and I would think of stuff and then have her sing it. And I mean, I've been doing that as long as I can remember. So I would definitely say that that part of it has come naturally for me for the most part.
Yeah. I mean, you sort of made a passing reference to this before about how not wanting to bring up gender. And I imagine that, I mean, do you find that you get boxed in as like a female musician and only get compared to like other female musicians?
All the time. Absolutely. I mean, gender is still very much so a genre, which is stupid. It doesn't really make sense. But I don't know. I mean, I guess we'll just take it for what it is and as a compliment, because there's a ton of amazing female-fronted bands and musicians, and they're awesome and great. So lots of times if I'm in that category or looped in with Courtney Barnett or Chastity Belt or whatever else is going on at the time, it's a compliment because I'm surrounded by a bunch of really talented people.
I mean, do you feel like there's been improvement in that area? I mean, I feel like there's so many women making like great rock records now that it's not really... It's even hard to notice sometimes if that's actually happening.
Yeah, no, for sure. Yeah, I would definitely say that there's been an improvement. And I think that people are a lot more aware of it, too, now than they have been in the past. It's kind of hard to say because I wasn't making music or doing stuff like this 10 years ago, so I don't know exactly how it was. But I know that there's been a lot of work towards getting gender equality for female musicians, like obviously the whole everything Kathleen Hanna did for women in music and that whole kind of movement and everything that came along and kind of followed after that, that's helped women in music out. But I would like to think that it's getting better every day.
All right. You mentioned before that when you got to college, that's when you first started listening to a lot of like sort of the canonical indie rock bands, Sonic Youth and all those sorts of bands. Mm-hmm. And when people talk about Bully, they usually will describe you as like a 90s sounding band. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering, like, I mean, do you feel like that is an accurate way to describe what you're doing? And I mean, is it weird to talk about rock music too always in the past tense? It seems like whenever a band tries to make rock music now, it's always sort of described as something that's already happened before. I mean, is that something you think about?
Yeah, it's very bizarre. Because, I mean, I was born in 1990, so constantly being compared to a 90s band is a little bit confusing, but I think, or I would like to think, that when people are making that reference, maybe they are kind of referring to two guitars, bass, drums, raw, more natural-sounding, energetic music. And by that I just mean not a bunch of tracks with synthesizers or crazy reverb or surfiness that's going on. Whether or not that's the case, I'm not sure. Maybe they think it just sounds like a Veruca Salt ripoff or something. I don't personally, but it's hard to say, but it is weird. Strange.
I mean, I always feel like there's always been that in rock music where, you know, every great band I could think of, on one hand they're trying to do something new, but on the other hand there's always that nod that you make to your roots. You know, like every great band is, you know, like going back to the Beatles covering Buddy Holly on their first couple records and Chuck Berry, and just kind of moving that forward. It does seem weird though now to be a rock band. It seems like you are kind of constantly shoved in that kind of pigeonhole, where you're not necessarily perceived to even be like a popular type group, that you are, it's always going to be like a retro thing. And you were talking before about, you know, wanting to make a career in music. I mean, does it make it, you know, 10 times harder playing the kind of rock music that you're doing in order, you know, to try to make a career?
I don't know. I mean, like, it's kind of hard in 2016 to just think of music as a career anyway, just because of so much streaming that's going on and vinyl and physical sales that have just, I think, decreased forever for probably the past 10 years, right? I don't know, last time there was a bump in them. I mean, maybe like vinyl in particular, there was a bump because it seems like people really like buying vinyl now, but I mean, physical sales, and now that there's Spotify and stuff, have definitely gone down a lot. And it seems like most of the money bands make is through playing live shows. And then if they can get a license or two here or there to kind of help them through the year, that'll work. But I don't know if it's harder for any particular genre. It's hard to say. Like, I don't know if it would be harder because it's a particular genre other than it just being difficult all around because it's music, you know?
Right.
Does that make any sense?
No, yeah.
Did I
answer
your question?
Yeah, yeah, totally. I mean, like for you, you know, again, covering a lot of those bands and when you got to college, like, what was it about that music that spoke to you, you know, as a music fan and also as a musician?
Yeah, a lot of it that I, or one thing that I remember pretty clearly is the first time I heard, like, Kim Deal or Kim Gordon, and the way that they sang was so powering and unconventional. It was really cool. It just seemed really risky and brave and edgy for them to not sing like, you know, I don't know, Christina Aguilera, but still own it and kind of, you know, do their own thing. Was that was really inspiring, especially for someone like myself who doesn't have an amazing a conventionally great singing voice, you know, like I can't go pull up a Beyonce song and just tear it to shreds. And someone would be like, "Tell that girl to stop, get off the mic. That sounds so bad." But that was a huge thing for me. And then I don't know. I would just say all around, there was some sort of edginess to it that I liked, and then definitely with stuff like, when I was got into the Replacements or listened to Liz Phair's Exile in Guyville, the lyrics stood out a lot. I think in a lot of rock and roll music, you can find a lot of really cool lyrics, maybe everywhere, but particularly for rock and roll, it seems like there's some thought put into it. Or definitely when I hear any Paul Westerberg song, I'm like, that is... how do you even think of those lyrics?
Right.
And I mean, their stuff kind of goes everywhere. I mean, I guess. But yeah, those were just a few of the things that grabbed my attention and that I could connect to and relate with. And
so, I mean, like you mentioned Liz Phair and Paul Westerberg. I mean, they're both, you know, especially Liz Phair and Exxon Guyville, where it's personal and also clever at the same time. I mean, was that sort of what was it about her lyrics that you liked?
I think it was, I really admired how straightforward the lyrics were. And I know that they got a lot of attention for the edginess to it or the provocativeness to them, but I really liked how personal they were and how straightforward they were, and how sometimes I think for me it's more difficult to just be really simple and straightforward than it can be to kind of paint a different picture or write something a little more abstract. And I know it's different for everybody, who what people like or whether or not they think one is more advanced than the other, but for me how personal they were and how simplistic. I just thought it was brave to just kind of, for her to just be like, this is what's going on, this is what happened. I don't know, you can take it as you will, but,
right.
You know, I don't know. It definitely stood out.
I mean, listening to the songs on Feels Like, and this is the lyrics and also like how you deliver them. I mean, the impression you get is that this is sort of like a personal, cathartic type record. But I'm wondering, I mean, do you consider yourself an autobiographical songwriter? Like, are you writing about your own experiences in a way? Or is it just sort of like a conduit that you're just kind of getting it out? It's not necessarily about your life, but it's something to scream about, I guess.
Everything on Feels Like is definitely about my life. I don't know if that's a good thing or not, but they're all pretty personal situations that have happened.
Like, what kinds of things in particular, like, inspire you as a songwriter?
I don't know. That's a broad question.
I mean, I'm guessing these weren't great things that happened to you that inspired these songs?
Yeah. No. Just usually when I end up writing a song, it's because something's on my mind or something's been bugging me, and it's a way to kind of sort it out and accept it and then just get it off my chest. And that's why I think most of the songs on Feels Like were written. A lot of things, too, that I can't put the words together to say to other people or to talk to people about, you can just put it in a song and then sing it or scream it every night, and it feels great. It feels really good, and it's just like a way to deal with the things that are kind of going on in your mind that you don't really know how to communicate. For me, that's what it is.
How about that song, Trash? Like, where does a song like that come from? Mm-hmm.
Trash is about a terrible relationship, which is pretty vague, but it's about, that one in particular, I was with my friend that night and we were just talking about things, but it's kind of just having a person in your life that's constantly bringing you down that you're really close with and almost too close to see that, and just them having the ability to make you feel so terrible. A lot of people have someone in their life like that, and you have to be pretty close with someone for them to just be able to completely tear you down, make you feel like you want to just curl up into a ball under a table. And that song is about those relationships.
And is that relationship over, hopefully?
Yes.
Okay. Now, I mean, because I'd read that that was your favorite song on the record. Is that right?
Yeah, I don't love the way that I recorded it, or necessarily the performance of the recording, but it's my favorite song to play live.
And it's interesting because a lot of the songs on Feels Like are, you know, up-tempo, kind of poppy in a way, and that's one of the slower songs, more abrasive, kind of has like a sludginess to it. Mm-hmm. And I've read that that's where you want to maybe bring the band, like that's kind of the direction you want to go in on the next record.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's maybe because it's my favorite one to perform live, but what I like about that song too is I can kind of relate it to whatever else has been going on or bringing me down that day. So every night when I get up on stage to perform it, it always seems fresh because you can kind of deliver your own meaning to it. So that's a huge part of why I like that song and why I like performing it every night is it always seems somewhat relevant.
Yeah.
Aside from that, I think I like the heaviness to it, and I know that a lot of the kind of faster, simple, poppy, bully songs that I wrote first, I feel like I'm just kind of over. I mean, I still enjoy playing them, but for the second record, I don't think that's the direction I want to go in.
Are they all going to be like really slow Melvins type songs?
No. And it's hard to say even because like I could say that and then the second record comes out and it's the quickest, poppiest record you've ever heard in your life. But if I think about it in my head, the direction I want to go. And I don't think that I'm talking about the tempo of the song, but I like the heaviness and the feeling that comes through Trash.
All right. Do you have like a platonic ideal in your head as far as like what a record should sound like? Like is there a record that you love that you're like, I want a record that sounds like that or has that kind of audio quality to it?
Oh God. Okay. So the other day we were listening in the van, just going through a bunch of stuff. I don't remember what we listened to. I think it was like some McCluskey, I don't really remember what else. A bunch of stuff from that era, and then we put on the Breeders Pod because that's like one of my favorite records, and every once in a while I need to listen to it, and Clay and I, our guitar player, were just like, holy shit, this sounds so good sonically. It just sounded worlds better than all the other records we were listening to before it, and I was just thinking like, Jesus, if I could make a record that sounds that good, I would be pretty happy. But just the separation and the kick drum and the snare and the vocals and where, I mean, the whole thing, it just blows my mind every time I listen to it.
Albini did that one, right?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if it was at Electrical or where, but I would assume he did it and it was at Electrical.
And I know that, you know, and you've talked about this a lot before, that you interned at Electrical Audio. Did you actually spend time with Albini at all?
Yeah, I mean, it was kind of like I would go in every day, I'd do my intern duties, and then whoever, after I finished all of that, whoever was in A or B engineering a session, I would go and sit in on and see. So I got to spend an equal amount of time with him and Greg Norman or Greg Warr, John Sampaolo, whoever was tracking. It was split up pretty evenly, but all of them were great, extremely helpful. I would just kind of watch the sessions, take pictures of mic placement, and then wait until there was a break and write all my questions down. And then when there was a break, I would just kind of ask them everything I had written down, and they were more than willing to answer everything. I think sometimes they would even give me pieces of paper with the sessions drawn out and where the mic placements were and why they were there and what was going through what preamps, and yeah, it was great.
Yeah. Now, and because Albini fascinates me, I've obviously never met him. He seems like an extremely smart guy, and then he also comes off, I guess, a huge crank sometimes in his interviews. But I mean, it sounds like, from what I've heard in person, he's like a really nice guy.
Yeah. I mean, I've never been in a situation that I've seen him be anything less than very respectful to anybody that he's been working around or had any interactions with. With that being said, I mean, I don't, you know, go out to bars with him or hang out with him. Usually if I'm around him, it's in a professional environment. We actually just got to play with them at Meredith in Australia, so that was really cool.
With Shellac?
Yeah. Meredith Festival was really cool too, but yeah, they were amazing. But yeah, no, to me, he's been nothing but an extremely respectful, kind, smart, very smart person.
So, are you going to be touring for a while yet? Do you know, like, when you'll be able to, you know, start working on another record?
Yeah. So we had, we were gone for about 3 months, had 2 weeks off for the holidays. Then left, and we've been on this tour, which wraps up February 7th. After that, we're supposed to have about a month and a half off, maybe 2 months, and I'm going to try and write a bunch of stuff, hopefully get to some demos. Then we get to festival season, so we kind of have that throughout, I think starting in April or May until August, we have festivals. And then hopefully after that, we can sit down and reserve some time to track the second record in the fall is what I'm hoping.
Now, you just said you were out for 3 months and now you're in the Midwest and it's like negative 10 degrees every day. I mean, do you like touring? Does it get to be hard? And like, how do you take care of yourself so you can like scream those songs every night and not lose your voice?
Yeah. Well, when it's warm out, I usually don't have to think about it. But when it's cold out, I have to be a lot more proactive as far as taking care of my body so I can sing every night. I just drink a lot of tea and whiskey. but I don't really take care of myself. I mean, I do for the most part. I'm not like, I don't get totally shit-faced every night because I don't have the energy or enough friends to do that. But yeah, these past couple of weeks when it's been cold, I've kind of just been drinking tea. I haven't had coffee in a while except for today, and that's only because there's caribous here. But yeah, just a lot of tea and sleep. I usually just try and sleep, you know, as much as I can get it, and yeah. I don't really go out. I guess I'm out every night, but
yeah. Well, and I guess like in this kind of weather, you have to drink whiskey just to stay warm.
Yeah, you need a little buzz.
All right, Alicia. Well, hey, thanks again for talking with me. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
All right.